We made this.
Welcome to One Rules Them All, a Lord of the Rings podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm your host, Baz Grind, and joining me this week in our exploration of Amazon Prime's The Rings of Power is fellow We Made This podcaster, Craig McKenzie. Welcome to One Rules Them All, Craig.
Hello, how's it going?
Glad to have you on here. Yeah, so this week we are talking about the sixth episode of The Rings of Power, Udun. But before we get into that, we'd like to ask each new guest about their Tolkien fandom. So, a couple of questions for you, Craig, first. So, Craig, are you a fan of Lord of the Rings, and when did you first get into the world of Tolkien?
Yeah, I first got into Lord of the Rings and Tolkien mainly through the films. Mm. And after I watched Fellowship of the Ring, I then read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings after the fact. And I'll confess, I find Tolkien's prose to be really dry and difficult to read. I've never made it through The Silmarillion for that reason, because it is just torturous to my...
It's a heavy book, to be fair, The Silmarillion. Yeah. That's one that the fans love, but yeah, I can understand that, certainly.
Yeah, but I do like the Lord of the Rings stuff, and I think the Hobbit movies, there's maybe 1.5 good films in there, really. Out of three, they shouldn't have made three of them, but there's a long and storied production issue behind that film that we probably won't go into here, but
yeah.
I like the franchise as it is now, and this TV show, I've had issues with it. I think whoever's running it has no real concept of pacing. And I know that there's deliberate pacing that people love, and particularly in this show, people will be loving it too. But I think there's a difference between deliberate pacing and wasting time. And I think this show does a lot of wasting time. There's aspects of it I really like, but there's also aspects of it that I find quite tedious.
Okay, fair enough then. So you like the original Lord of the Rings movie, the three movies that Peter Jackson did in the beginning of 2000s, yeah?
Yeah, I think he did a really great job of translating that into something watchable, which is no mean feat.
Yeah, I would argue that the Lord of the Rings movies themselves, not so The Hobbit, but the Lord of the Rings movies are probably a masterclass in how to do a really good adaptation. Fellowship of the Ring, you could have had a whole side plot with Tom Bombadil, for example, but it would not have worked for the adaptation of the film. So yeah, it's that's great. And I agree with The Hobbit as well, I guess, to an extent. I mean, they should have been two movies. You know, there was enough they were expanded upon with some stuff. I can see why the Necromancer, for example, which wasn't in the book. I can see why I did that, but still, two movies rather than three. Three did feel like it was a... certainly stretching it a little bit thin at times. But, I think a lot of people have kind of come in for the movies, which is great too. I mean, I read Lord of the Rings. Well, technically, I did actually come for the movies. I don't know if you've ever seen the animated Ralph Bakshi version from the 70s.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. Well, that's how I got into it. When I was 10, I was 10 years old. I'd read The Hobbit as a kid, actually. I read The Hobbit a couple of times. And I really like The Hobbit because I've always loved fantasy. But I watched the Bakshi Lord of the Rings when I was 10. And, well, what is this? This is amazing. So me went to the library and got Lord of the Rings, and that's when my love of fantasy kind of came to fruition. But, yeah, it's great that I think a lot of people really did come through the films, and particularly, yeah, the Lord of the Rings. I mean, they were brilliant adaptations. And, I'm really glad that kind of brought a lot of fans to the world of Tolkien as well. I do understand what you're saying about prose. Obviously, it's... sometimes it's context and when things were written. My experience was probably Dune. I'd never read Dune until a couple of years ago, so I read it before the film came out. And while amazing story and I love the film, it was very ponderous trying to get through some of that. That took me quite a long time to get through Dune as a novel, because while I appreciate storytelling, it was, you know, it's over 50 years old. Prose is written very differently. So I kind of appreciate where you might be coming from there with Lord of the Rings, that the style of writing is quite slow and ponderous and quite maybe old-fashioned as well.
Yeah, and also Tolkien was practiced in writing textbooks, wasn't he? So he's predisposed to putting a lot of information into a paragraph. So they introduce a character and they tell you their entire family lineage. And then by the time you've gotten through all that, you've forgotten why he's there in the first place.
No, that's fair. So you did touch briefly about the Rings of Power then. So you talked a bit on the pacing, but what are your general thoughts on the Rings of Power so far?
Like I said, I am enjoying it. I do have my issues with it. I think there's too many storylines going on, and I'm not quite clear on how they connect. For example, this episode, it just leaves out two of them, doesn't it? So, or is it one of them? One or two of them. Well, it leaves out a couple. And I think that's probably a good way to do it in terms of let's focus on the things that are important, but I'm not quite sure how everything links in. So Elrond and the Harfoots and so forth aren't in this plot at all, in this episode at all, because they're not relevant. So I'm just wondering how they'll tie into everything. And obviously I'm used to Lord of the Rings where the story splits, but it's all still working towards a singular goal. So maybe once it all comes together, I'll see the point. But at the moment, sometimes I feel like it's taking me away from the things I'm interested in to go towards something I'm less interested in.
Yeah, no, again, I think that's fair. I mean, I adore anything with Elrond and Durin and dwarves, and they weren't in this episode. And actually, I mean, we'll talk about the episode itself, but I didn't actually miss them for the first time this week, but I love that storyline. I think it's a difficult one because, I mean, this is covering a broad space of time. This isn't, I mean, Lord of the Rings, even though I think the book takes place over about a year, it really takes place over a few weeks, really, isn't it? No more than a few weeks, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and The Hobbit, the same thing. So, but there's obviously a grander scope with the Rings of Power. And I guess there's kind of pluses and minuses to kind of where that storyline goes. I mean, you kind of get it. It's going to end up with the prologue to the Fellowship of the Ring, that big battle to defeat Sauron, and that's probably where it's going to go to. And what I'm enjoying as a fan is that even though I'm a Lord of the Rings fan and I've read the appendices and Silmarillion and everything else, it's very broad strokes. There's a lot of detail here that I don't know. So it's great. It's kind of great in that sense that I know kind of where the destination is of sorts, but a lot of it, like how the Harfoots fit into, for example, until this episode, how the Southland people fit into it, has been a complete mystery. So, but I think at the same time, while there's a great mystery, it's very broad, and it's a 5-year plan. It's going to take a while to get. We're not going to get to the battle and the defeat of Sauron and the Rings. I mean, it's the Rings of Power. I'm not sure the Rings are even going to appear in season one, or maybe at the very end of the first season. So, yeah, I think there's a degree of patience with this, and it's probably one that's going to be almost interesting to re-review once the show is done, or certainly once seasons are done, and kind of look back and see kind of where it is.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the why of the rings being forged, the ones that are giving to the elves and the dwarves and the humans and so forth, because the Lord of the Rings prologue just says that we're done. They don't say why. And then after that, you get Sauron forging his ring because he feels a bit left out, I suppose. And well, we still haven't got to Sauron yet. We don't know who he is or where he is, although I do have a theory on who he might be, and I think he might be among us, but we'll probably get to that. I imagine it's probably a theory that everybody else has. I don't think I'm clever enough to have thought to be the only one that's thought this, but he's kind of a looming shadow in the distance, I suppose, which is what he was in the movies largely.
Yeah.
It was about the threat of Sauron rather than the actual presence of Sauron, I suppose.
Yeah, I think what it was almost like, it's quite fun in a way. There were probably two mysteries running through Rings of Power, which you've probably discussed every week with each guest, is one, who is Sauron? And two, who is a stranger if he's not Sauron? have you got any thoughts on, I know the Harfoots weren't in this episode, have you got any thoughts on who the stranger might be?
Well, I'm just thinking he must be Gandalf, because he looks vaguely Gandalfish, and he communes with animals, and it might serve as an origin story for why he likes the little folk.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what they're suggesting. I think chronologically, if you look at the appendices, it doesn't quite make sense. Gandalf doesn't turn up until after the defeat of Sauron, because there's like 2,000-3,000 years between that and obviously Lord of the Rings. But, you know, maybe they're playing a bit loose and fast with it. I mean, you know, there are other wizards out there. So I think the suggestion of Gandalf makes the most sense. Whether there is Gandalf, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Have you got any thoughts on Sauron then? Do you think we've seen Sauron yet in the show?
Yes. So I'm just looking at my notes for names, because sometimes I forget names. So Halbrand is my working theory.
Ah.
Because he just seems to be a bit shifty sometimes.
Yeah. Possibly. I mean, we don't know, do we? I think he's the Witch King. I think he's eventually, because he's obviously this king, I think he's going to be the Witch King of Angmar, the leader of Nazgul. But that's my theory. I know everyone's got, and that's what I'm really enjoying about the Rings of Power. Everyone's got a theory on, there is some momentum, and I think there's momentum in this episode, but I do agree there's a lot of kind of world building happening at the same time. I think maybe the first season might be a bit slower because of that. But there's also some really compelling mysteries and kind of what is going on and what people's agendas are and who these people are and who Sauron is. I think it's quite fun to go, you know, is Sauron this person, is Sauron that person? And I'm sure we'll probably find out by the end of season one. But I quite like the mystery.
I'm really grateful for Amazon Prime watching it on there, because whenever people are on screen, sometimes I forget who they are because there's so many characters. So I just press up on my controller and it just gives me a list of everyone in the scene.
It's very, very useful. But yeah. And again, for podcasts, I'm like, oh, who's that character? And I pause. Oh, that's make my note. It's great. I can do it. Amazon is a very, very useful thing on Amazon Prime to have the character and the actor on there, definitely.
Yeah, I think other streaming services should perhaps copy that and throw that in, because sometimes you're just like, who is this guy? I'm writing a review on this. Who is this guy? I'm not writing a review on this, but and sometimes I'm just, who's this actor or who's this character? Because they're just credited. The actor's just credited at the opening of the episode and it doesn't tell you who they are and stuff. So yeah, this is, I mean, not related to the episode as such, but it's a useful feature, especially in something like this where the names are all a bit confusing and all over the place. And so many people look quite similar as well. There's an awful lot of white men with long hair.
But at least there is some diversity. I know there's this whole, this kind of vile element of the internet that's kind of, oh, it's woke. He's got more strong female characters and it's got people of color, like Arondir was a black elf, and obviously Lenny Henry is a black half. And it's like, you're going, which no time for at all. But I do at the same time. There was kind of a lot of characters do look similar, particularly the elves. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, and a lot of the humans as well, because they're just white men with long hair.
Quite possible. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they got the Aragorn trademarks there. Aragorn one, yeah, definitely. So before we get into the episode then, a couple more things. Who's your favourite character and what's your favourite storyline on The Rings of Power so far? What are you enjoying the most?
So I'm enjoying Arondir. I think he's a really interesting character. And I think Galadriel's possibly the most complex, and particularly because of some of the things she does in this episode.
Yeah.
There's a lot beneath the surface there. Some of the other characters, suffer from getting lost in scenes with really flowery dialogue, so sometimes you don't really get a full sense of who they are. I do like the Harfoots, just because of how charming they are, and their story seems to be a bit more simple in that respect, as in their dialogue is short and to the point, and that makes sense for them because they're not highborn or whatever. The elves take forever to say nothing because they live forever, so why waste time? I've been referenced that in the previous episode, where Elrond says that elves don't appreciate how long it takes to do something because they live so long.
The Harfoots are very charming and almost like a palate cleanser after the high drama of Numenor or the elves. And I think so. I quite appreciate it too. Yeah. So let's get into episode 6 then, Udon. So it was written by showrunner John D. Payne and Patrick Bouquet, and also Nicholas Adams and Justin Doble. So there's four people involved on the script. So in this episode, directed by Charlotte Branstrom, Adar marches his army on Ostrifith, I think that's how you pronounce that's the Elven Tower at the beginning, as Arondir and Bronwyn prepare to fight for their home, and Galadriel, Halbrand and Numenorians land at Middle-earth. So, Broadly, were you a fan of this episode?
Yeah, I think this was probably the most propulsive one we've had since the first one, actually. Because I've talked about the pacing in some of the other episodes, and maybe you could have cut some of that down, but this one, it keeps it moving. It actually reminded me of any of the movies, really, where there's a sense of urgency to it, there were stakes to it, they managed to get a bit of character in there. So this is probably my favourite of the lot, and maybe that sounds a bit, cheap that I'm saying, oh yeah, the action one's my favourite, but I saw more to it than the action as well, and I liked the fact that it felt like it was going somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. It reminded me of, and actually it's based on what you discussed before, some of the Game of Thrones episodes where they have like episode 9, the big battle episode, and it was always like, you'd have lots of interweaving plot lines happening throughout the series. Some episodes would be more kind of fast or slower paced than others. And then you'll get to that kind of focus episode, which was big, and it was almost like one storyline. And sometimes, as much as I enjoy seeing the Harfoots or seeing the dwarves or seeing the elves, I think there was a very singular focus to this episode. It was basically one plot line, because obviously two plot lines converged into one. And it kind of, it felt like an event. It was it was almost like it was not quite the scale, obviously, though the ending we'll talk about later on, but it was kind of almost like this is, I got Helm's Deep vibes from this episode. I don't think it was as good as the Helm's Deep from the Two Towers by any means, but I thought there was that kind of that sense of urgency and desperation, and the kind of the raising of the stakes in this episode kind of gave me a little bit of that kind of Helm's Deep vibe.
Yeah, definitely. And that's almost what I was thinking with it. It feels a bit like a turning point or a midpoint. And to continue the Helm's Deep comparison, the previous episode is effectively those two or three scenes that happened before the Battle of Helm's Deep where everybody was preparing for it, but they stretch out into an entire episode. And whether they should have or not is completely up for debate. I'm sure you discussed it last week, but I definitely liked that we had movement here, because I have been struggling with the fact that it hasn't been moving that quickly. And the way I've been consuming the show is I saw the first two episodes in the cinema when they were doing the free screenings of it, which was really good. And then after that, I've essentially been watching two at a time.
Okay.
Which is, I guess, the way I've chosen to consume the show. But it feels like when you watch two at a time, you get a little bit of movement. Whereas I feel like I might be frustrated if I was watching it once a week. So maybe this should have been released as a full season at once.
Yeah, I mean, there's pluses and minuses there, because in one sense, particularly all the mystery we talk about, Sauron, the Stranger, a lot of stuff going on. Yeah. I've quite like, particularly on the We Made This Discord chat we have as well, people have been talking about these mysteries, and they're not quite water cooler moments, but there's certainly that kind of debate going on week, which I'm really enjoying. But at the same time, I kind of get that it's taking its time to build this world, particularly as, you know, it's going to have five seasons. You know, a lot of shows, you know, you kind of go season to season, hoping it's going to get more. Whereas I think the money and the focus and all the attention put on this show, despite the kind of the aggressive anti-woke reviews, whatever you want to call them, or all the hatred you've got spilled against it, which is why Amazon have actually taken down reviews of The Rings of Power on Amazon Prime. But it's going to have five seasons. That, you know, I can't see this being a show that gets cancelled after the third season. So they can take their time. So from one sense, I really enjoy the mystery, but in another sense, I kind of feel that it's going to be a really interesting experience watching it as essentially about hour and 10 minutes. So basically like a 9-hour movie, which is what it will be when season one's done. And yeah, this kind of episode felt like that kind of big turning point going into the third act of, you know, we've built everything now, and then we're going to start to raise the stakes more. So I see what you mean. I think it's going to be a very different experience to go back and watch it kind of all in one go.
Yeah, and I generally prefer weekly releases, because it means that you can take the time to sit and think about things. But I think the approach some people take is the 9-hour movie just randomly cut into chunks. Mm. Like they did that with Andor. The first three episodes are one episode, but they just randomly cut it into 40-ish minute chunks. So it's clear that they're planning this with binging in mind, I suppose. But it sometimes means the individual episodes themselves have no real identity, because even though I've been watching them two at a time, I'd struggle to go back and think, oh yeah, episode three is where that happens.
Continue to build the plot. I think this is the first one where you can say this is what happened in this episode, whereas the previous ones,
this is the one where the battle happens.
Yeah, and where things like to fall apart. Yeah, so I mean, yes, so let's talk about Undyn then. So yeah, it was, I think for me, I've enjoyed all the plot lines, and I will always lap up the high fantasy and the high dialogue and all the high drama. And I'm a big kind of high fantasy fan. I think I've probably not clicked with Aronde and Bronwyn as much as other characters. I think it kind of, I've always felt a little bit disconnected from the Southlands plot, kind of going, where is this going? You know, are these the Haradrim, the kind of the people that ride the elephants in Two Towers? Is that kind of what it's going for? But of course, this episode, I think, you know, having done a lot of those bits with the characters, and particularly Rhonda and Bronwyn, I know they were kind of going for this kind of Aragorn and Arwen type romance, this kind of immortal and immortal romance thing. But I didn't get that in those opening episodes. But I think I got their relationship for the first time in this episode.
Yeah, I think they were deliberately pointing in that direction for this particular episode. I find them interesting, actually, as a contrast to Galadriel and Halbrand, because they Galadriel and Halbrand take turns pulling each other out of their vengeful rages in this episode almost. It's just, it's my turn to be vengeful. No, don't do that. And then they go back and forth. And there's a hint at a romance between the two of them as well. Whether that will come to anything, we don't know. But Bronwyn and Arendi are there less conflicted and they're more innately good, for want of a better word. So there's a definite contrast between the two of them. And it's interesting that it's elf and human in both sides of it. So it kind of shows you that there is a spectrum, I suppose, to the elves, and they're not above sort of baser instincts.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And I mean, if you go look at the Silmarillion, for example, which they don't have the right Silmarillion, but like Beren and Lúthien is kind of one of the first relationships, this mortal man and this elf, which was always the inspiration for the Aragorn and Arwen stuff later on. So they're kind of playing with it again here as well. It's quite fun to do. I think that there's a really good, and we'll come on to Galadriel and Halbrand later, but I do agree there's a really interesting chemistry between them. But I like there's also the kind of that they've both got a darker side to them, which I think they both kind of draw upon on each other as well. Whereas I think, yeah, you're right, Arondi is just, and Bronwyn, they're both trying to save the people from the darkness. And you get to see them really step up in this episode. What did you think of Arondir's speech to the people, and then Bronwyn's speech with to her son Theo? There was nice moments with both of those.
Yeah, I thought they were good speeches, and they came right from those characters. I think one thing the show's done very well is establish those two characters, at least individually, and then those relationships. And I don't know that Theo is well developed enough for the speech to hit as prominently as it should, but certainly from the point of view of what was actually said and what it meant, that worked really well. And there's that general sense that Theo is just in over his head with the shard of the blade, thinks he can deal with it, but obviously he can't. We're definitely heading down a dark path with that guy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I quite like Arondir's speech. I think it wasn't as impactful, but Bronwyn's speech was wonderful. In the end, the shadow is but a small and passing thing. There is light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. Find the light and the shadow will not find you. I think it was a lovely, very thematic kind of words there as well. And I think what I liked was, you know, particularly with the absolute gorgeous music that was playing over it as well, the way it went from her kind of comforting Theo to visit all the people in the village. And again, that was very Helm's Deep, you know, start seeing the kind of people impacted by the incoming battle and the arrival of the orcs. So that really struck with me, definitely.
Yeah. And it makes me think about what the show is actually about, because Lord of the Rings, a lot of people have spoken about it being potentially an allegory for World War II, and that's certainly Peter Jackson's reading of it. And that's what he was putting across in his films. And Tolkien said, no, I hate allegory, I would never do that, but he clearly did.
Well, he did. I mean, Tolkien, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in Lord of the Rings, like Frodo being impacted by not able to move on after the events. Yeah, that's the impact of, if you come out of World War One. World War II, what does that do to you? How do you move on from that? Yeah. And obviously there's the industrialization, the great war machine with Saruman, certainly. Yeah. So I think, yeah, he definitely drew upon the experience of going through these two world wars, particularly, I think, World War One in particular, in his work.
Yeah. And then this show, I wonder if it's about cycles of darkness being temporary, because we're looking at these really horrible times politically and globally and environmentally at the moment, and it's a suggestion that, well, this is temporary. But the other side of that is that positivity only lasts so long before darkness descends, because if you look at Middle Earth, it's cyclical, isn't it? We're going from, well, we start this show with in a period of relative peace and tranquility, and then we're watching it just go to pot, and then it'll get better for a while, and it'll go to pot again over the time of Lord of the Rings. And I don't know, it's a cynical reading of it in the sense that it's going to get worse, always going to get worse, regardless of how good it gets. So it's almost like there's sprinkles of tranquility in the middle of just horrible events, rather than it being the other way around.
Or vice versa, then dark things happen, but then there were periods of peace. There were ways we can read it, because I think there were long periods of peace, and then obviously the end of the First Age and Morgoth, who was obviously, they didn't really do much of Morgoth, because again, it's the Silmarillion, and the showrunners don't have access to the rights to the Silmarillion, so it's more drawn from the appendices.
It's crazy, isn't it? The rights.
But there's a lot of stuff in the appendices they've drawn upon. If you look at the appendices, you know, characters like Miriel, the Queen Regent, are in there. You know, these characters are they aren't I think Halbrand's new, but most of the characters actually, like Durin and Gil-galad, these characters that are in the appendices. So, you know, they're taking a very like one line reference to this period, this happened, and then drawing it out. But yeah, it's a cyclical nature. You had that period of peace and tranquility with the High Trees and the Undying Lands. Then you had Morgoth, and obviously all the darkness happened there, and obviously Galadriel's brother died in the war, and then obviously we've come now to the end of that, and there's a period of peace again. Obviously the dwarves are prospering, and the elves are prospering, and Numenor's kind of prospered, even though they've kind of shut themselves off the world, but you know, they've prospered out of this darkness, and then it's going to come around again, and then there'll be peace again, and then you'll have Gondor, and you'll have the Shire, and all that stuff that happened, and then the darkness will happen with the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. So it's going to keep happening, but there's also the hope of light. But I think what's really interesting, there is a tension running throughout the Rings of Power as well. And you see it particularly with the Southlands in this episode, is that it's all going to fall apart. You know, Khazad-dûm looks beautiful. I love Khazad-dûm in this series. But, you know, the Balrog is going to come and that's going to lay waste to that. And it's all going to get destroyed.
Yeah.
And the same, well, Lindon isn't around. Eregion, you know, where the Smith is as well. These places don't exist, and there's a reason for that. It's all going to fall apart. So at Numenor, we've touched upon the Great Flood, and Numenor isn't around. Gondor is, and Gondor doesn't even exist yet. So you know, there are things that are going to change, and it's all. And in one sense, you know, it's going to get messy when things really start to fall apart. And we see it with this episode with the Southlands, but yeah, it's interesting, those kind of cycles of light and darkness then. So let's talk about that. So I think one of the things I really appreciate about Udun is that for the first time, I really got a sense of where the show was going. And I think it was that realization that the Southlands we were watching was actually Mordor. Had you guessed that's what this place was before this episode?
I hadn't, although I suppose I could have if I'd looked at the map more clearly, because I would have probably seen, oh, look, that's where Mordor is on the map that's in any edition of Lord of the Rings that you can open, or just look up online, Map of Middle Earth. But I didn't really think along those lines, because I suppose I wasn't necessarily expecting Mordor to be created this soon. I thought that might have taken a while, but it took us this long to get to Middle Earth, really, because we've spent so much time on the fringes of it. Well, some of the characters.
Yeah.
Obviously, some of the characters have already been there. But yeah, it's quite a devastating ending. It's that, this massive destruction, creating this new horrible dark place that will persist for centuries.
Yeah, I mean you got the first hints of it, I guess, with episode 3 Adar, when Galadriel saw that kind of plan, and the that symbol of Sauron was actually Mordor. That was very, very, very cool. But I thought the Southlands were further south. I thought these were the people that were trying to kind of move beyond their allegiance to evil with Morgoth, who was Sauron's boss, and trying to find a way back, and probably going to fail, because I thought these are the people that are the ones that kind of, the men that fight for Sauron, the ones that ride the elephants, that kind of turn up in Two Towers and then wreak havoc in the Return of the King. But it didn't click until this episode. Was like, oh, it's when you saw that map and you saw the arrival of the Numenorians, and you kind of went, oh crap, this is Mordor. And we've seen this beautiful land with these lovely trees and forests and waterfalls. And there's a big mountain in the background, this lovely snow-capped mountain. And then you go, oh, crap, that's Mount Doom. And I think it was like, well, this is where it's going. Even then, I did not expect the ending of the episode. But I think it added another sense of kind of almost futility. You know, because you talk about the cycle of light and darkness. It was like, you know, these people, you know, this place of beauty is going to end, and we've seen Return of the King. We've seen what Mordor looks like. It's not pretty.
Yeah, well, that's what brought to mind the whole cynical reading of it, because they achieve a victory in this episode, but it's so short-lived. Yeah. It's undone almost immediately.
Definitely. It's it's a bleak. I mean, because you have that victory, it's what makes the ending so unexpected, I think, as well.
Yeah, it just seems to come out of nowhere, which is the point.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Hello, and this is Frame to Frame, part of the We Made This podcast network. We are a podcast that take two seemingly unconnected films and slam them together with the most obscure theme that we can find. I'm Andy Williams.
And I'm Sean Wilson.
And every Wednesday, you'll be able to find out a little bit more about the different themes and different films that we look into. You can hear moments such as this.
Gwyneth Paltrow has as many Oscars as David Cronenberg. That's just wrong. in every sense of the word.
Yeah, but you can't get a candle that smells like David Cronenberg's. No, wait, I'm not going to go there.
No, don't do that.
I mean, we've done nearly 10 minutes on why you dislike Zack Snyder, and that was just the first person that I mentioned as a talented name within the film.
Now you've got to take us in a positive direction, please.
Okay. Jared Butler is the lead of this film.
Oh, that's not a good start. That's really not a good start at all. Keep going. I just want to say, I really love your philosophy about no matter how good or bad a movie is, there's a lot of effort that goes into it. I really like that philosophy because I find myself grappling with that. It's kind of like it's really easy to tear something down because the finished product that comes out in the cinema or on streaming is nominally bad, but it has actually had a fair amount of effort that went into it, regardless exactly. of how that's translated.
Be sure to check your podcast app of choice every Wednesday to find new episodes. You'll be able to like, subscribe, and find us on social media at Frame2FramePod.
So let's talk about some of the big action sequences of the episode. Let's start with Arondir single-handedly taking down that tower to stop Adar's first attack. What did you think of the opening sequence?
Definite Legolas vibes with yeah. that. He's an elf and he can do anything. It seems he can bring down an entire army by himself almost. So there's definite Legolas vibes there. I think that was really well done. The action generally was very well put together. It's not quite, as you say, on the scale of what Peter Jackson was doing, but considering it's a TV show, regardless how much money they've spent on it, they managed to really focus it in quite a way that makes it seem like it's bigger than it is.
Oh, definitely. I think the only thing that it feels a little bit small for me, generally, with the whole Southlands pre-Mordor arc, is that we've had two villages. One village has obviously been wiped out. You see that in when Bronwyn and Arondir go to find another village. And this village,
yeah.
I feel like this should be, you know, really it's only a handful of villages fighting in the end. And I kind of felt like, where are all the other villages? Is that it? You know, Mordor is a big place. Yeah. And maybe in the next episode, we'll see refugees from our villages with the volcano. I don't know. But it kind of, that's the only gripe I have with this episode, was that actually, given what it actually was, I thought we would have seen a part of it. But actually, it was suggested, particularly with Halbrand arriving as well, that this is it. This is Halbrand's people. And actually, I kind of feel like there's a lot we haven't seen.
Yeah, it seems to be simplifying it a little bit, which is bizarre considering how much time they take to tell other aspects of the story. To rush this part will seem out of place if that's what they do. Obviously, the aftermath hasn't been covered yet, but but certainly they seem to have just brought this out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's like Halbrand's... Yeah.
Well, not nowhere, but...
It's like Halbrand's the returning king of two villages. It's like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
But as I said, maybe we'll see more of that. Maybe this is the bit that's been impacted. Bronwyn's village is the most heavily impacted by this attack. But actually, because maybe the direct lines to the, you know, firing up Mount Doom. But actually, maybe we're going to see more refugees. We're going to see the devastation across the rest of what is Mordor later. Maybe that might happen. So let's talk about the initial attack on the vision. I mean, I think this is, you know, again, Helm's Deep-wise, I thought there was a real tension going into that sequence.
Yeah, it showed you how difficult everything was going to be, didn't it? How difficult this enemy was to fight and how inexperienced most of the people fighting it were as well, because it took them so long to just take down that very small or relatively small attacking force at first. And if Arondir wasn't there, they would have probably lost.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there was some great sequences in there. I like the kind of the flaming cart and kind of put him into a fiery kill zone and then that kind of desperation.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a brutal fight as well. Very well choreographed, the fight between the villagers and the orcs as well.
Was it Arondir getting a mouthful of orc
mode? Oh, yeah. With that was a beast of an orc. I thought that was a fantastic sequence when he cuts out the eye and then the blood drips onto him as he's been throttled to death. That was a really kind of intense sequence.
Yeah, it was really good. It was more brutal than probably most of what was in the Lord of the Rings movies, although I suppose Peter Jackson wasn't going for gore in the same way, whereas on streaming you can do whatever.
Yeah, I think there was a probably balance there, because I mean, Peter Jackson comes from a horror background, and you saw it in things like The Dead Marshes. You know, there were moments when he could really ramp up the horror, and it was fantastic, but I almost wanted a little bit more, and you did get gore, but you didn't get that much, whereas I feel like, yeah, you've definitely, there's a brutality about the series sometimes, particularly in this episode, where you see it's a bit more visceral, the actual fighting and the bloodshed and then the death that's happening.
Yeah, though I've never seen Game of Thrones, but I imagine it's nothing compared to what Game of Thrones was doing.
No, not really. It's a little bit closer, and maybe because it's a TV series, there and obviously House of Dragons out as well. So maybe there's a little sense of. They've been released at the same time. I don't know if that's coincidental or not, but it definitely feels like there's a bit of competing with Game of Thrones. And even though it's very different, and I think Game of Thrones is a bit more, it has less of that kind of high drama and high dialogue that I said you might find a little bit stilted at times. I love all that stuff, but I love both shows. I love Game of Thrones and House of Dragon as well. But I think it's a bit more maybe more real and human in Game of Thrones, whereas I think this one is a little more high drama. But with things like this, I think it's probably where they're going as close as they can with the kind of Game of Thrones kind of fans with things like all the bloodshed and the fighting without going for that 18 mark, because they obviously want to attract. I mean, I'm assuming this is probably a 15 really, because there's still a lot of violence in it, but it's kind of trying to get a slightly broader audience too.
Yeah, find that middle ground.
Yeah. So what about the twist that they've been fighting their own people in Orgarma?
I kind of saw that coming. There was just something about it that seemed to be obvious. But I get that the people fighting them didn't know that. So once they found out, it was, oh God, what have we been doing? And it was the idea that these people had been enslaved and turned on their own people is just a horrific notion as well.
Yeah, it was never going to end well. I mean, you saw a bit of the last episode when they basically made their blood sacrifice once they formed their allegiance and they were going to die. But I think just the brutality of actually they stuck them in armor and set them off to basically be killed. I mean, that's what it was. It was all a trap, really. But I think what was really good about it as well is that the fight was so brutal. Then you had like the big orcs. There were obviously a couple of orcs there as well. And then that giant orc fight in Arondir. But it seemed so desperate. So when you had that victory and they won, it was like, yes, and then the arrows come and they start getting massacred. And there was a point where I thought, Bronwyn's, okay, they've now I finally care about Rondi and Bronwyn's relationship, and they've killed Bronwyn. And I thought that was what happened. Generally, there was a real sense of desperation as they retreat back to their keep, which is basically the inn, wasn't it, when the arrows have been fired against them.
Yeah, it was. And to continue that World War II allegory, it's the idea of we've put your people in these installations, so if you attack them, then you have to kill your own people, almost.
Yeah. So what do you think of the charge of the Numenor cavalry then, and the arrival at the village?
Yeah, it was really cool. I always love a bit of cavalry in Lord of the Rings, and it's very reminiscent of the Rohirrim appearing in the Two Towers to save the day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a cavalry charge is great. And obviously they got a bunch of trained horses and showed people how to ride them and stuff. It was a great sequence.
It was. I mean, yeah, again, that kind of the end of, again, going back to the Helm's Deep vibe, it felt like you've had that fight and then literally down to close quarters then, as you said, with Two Towers, by the end, most of the arms are dead and literally they're fighting the keep. And then the Rohirrim arrive. And it's very similar here. I think it was very deliberate to kind of go on those Helm's Deep vibes with this episode. I think when they arrived and save the day, it was that kind of, it was reminiscent of that triumph moment, which probably, again, with the twist of the volcano at the end, makes it much bleaker, because you think, aha, they've arrived and they save the day, and it was great, and the charge and the music and everything. Again, I love the music on this show. I thought Bear McCreary is doing a really good job as well, and it was wonderful to watch.
Yeah, and then to continue the sort of mirroring of Lord of the Rings movies, the Galadriel horse chase was very similar to Arwen running away from Ringwraith.
Very much so.
Instead, she was pursuing, but it's very similar. And I didn't pick up on this myself, but someone mentioned that she even says the same thing, the Elvish word for faster, to the horse. Right. So pretty deliberate, I suppose.
Yeah, I thought Galadriel pursuing Adar for the forest with that music again was like, this is Lord of the Rings. This is the Fellowship of the Ring. I love that sequence of the movies. And I say, obviously, they went for the ring race. They went the chase in the forest. They went for Helm's Deep. They really went for those big, crowd-pleasing Lord of the Rings moments in this, and I absolutely loved it as well. Some really good stuff in that battle when they arrive as well, like the using the chains to massacre the orcs was very, very, very. You could see these were trained soldiers, and they it was very different to the Rohirrim in a way as well. I quite like that. They felt more the Rohirrim almost like they, the horse and the rider almost won, whereas this was slightly different. These were trained soldiers who use horses to basically fight, and I think with the chains was certainly very cool. And Galadriel, talked about the legacy vibes of Rondo at the beginning. They've had it before, they had it in the first episode, but Galadriel, that those moves that she was doing when she would kind of half backflip off the side of the horse and fight the orcs as well, I thought was fantastic. It was really, really fun.
It's something I wouldn't have expected of Galadriel as well, because my experience of her in the Lord of the Rings movies and the Hobbit movies is she's a bit of a magic wielder. Even when they fight what turns out to be Sauron in the third Hobbit movie, she's casting spells and things. So she seems to move away from the more physical combat as she gets older.
Yeah, I think maybe she picks up the mantle of other characters, you know, with things change later on, because a lot of the elven characters in this aren't around when you get to things like Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit as well. But I think that's what's really interesting. I know this is kind of, they've called her a Mary Sue character. And I hate that term, you know, because she's strong and she fights and she's skilled. But I love her. I think Moffat Clark has such great conviction and passion in what she does in the show as well. And it's just really cool, you know, all these sequences. You know, she's very strong. She's very strong personality, and she's also very skilled as well. And I like that. I think it's great to see a new side of the character. But then there's quieter moments. You see the Galadriel that you see in the Lord of the Rings movies as well. So I don't think it's a different character. It's just a much younger and probably a much more action packed fighting version of the character than the one we see later on.
Yeah, and then the Mary Sue claims that's all just blatant sexism, isn't it? Because she does explain that she trained and things in earlier episodes. It's just you don't see it. It's the talk of... This kind of talk comes out all over the place. You, with the Black Panther Wakanda Forever coming up, and the speculation as to who's going to be the Black Panther in that, and then people saying, if it's Shuri, then we need to see her training. It's like, well, you didn't need to see T'Challa training.
Yeah.
And we just accepted Legolas was a badass. We didn't see him training. We didn't see Aragorn training. We didn't see Gimli training. It's just because she's a woman. It's how can she fight like that? We need to see her go through some long montage where she starts off being useless and then ends up less useless. But the show firmly establishes that after her brother died, she threw herself into this stuff.
Absolutely. And you know, she's the high commander of the Northern armies. You know, that she's a general. She's very, very skilled in what she does. And, I disagree with all those arguments. And, there is definitely this toxic element out there. But I think we've probably covered it on previous episodes. So I think let's move on to actually on the episode itself as well. Okay, so I think, there's some... Talk about Galadriel. There's some really interesting work with Galadriel and Elendil and Isildur too. What do you think of the scene when Galadriel meets Isildur on the ships at the beginning?
So that's the one where it's I can see land and you can't yet, that kind of stuff. Yeah, that was a really interesting scene. I like the way that they two related to each other. And again, I was surprised to see such a profound connection between them, because in Lord of the Rings, Galadriel never really talks about knowing Isildur. Yeah. It's more the Elrond has a connection to him in those films. So it was a bit of a surprise, I guess. And I've picked up a lot on the Galadriel performance in this. She doesn't seem to be emulating Cate Blanchett, and I know Elrond wasn't in this episode, but there's a bit of Hugo Weaving in the way that he plays Elrond in this show. And I find it interesting. I'm going to emulate this actor and I'm not going to emulate this actor, but the conversation between them, it was just one of those little quiet, introspective moments before the battle type things. You see them all the time. There's, especially in Lord of the Rings, in every film before they're about to go into a big battle, they always have a bit of a quiet moment between two people. There's, was it Legolas and I think, I forget who, in Return of the King, but it's just where Legolas is like, things are about to go down. And it's just this quiet moment. So it's the idea of, I can't see land yet, but don't worry, you'll see it soon enough. And it's the idea of, this is coming, but we, you know, take your moment here, take a breath. That's what the scene was telling me.
Yeah, definitely. And I find that when we have those quieter gladiator moments, there's a bit more Cate Blanchett in that. I think particularly going back to the beginning, when with things like episode one, when you had those Elrond and gladiator scenes at Lindon, I thought I could really get a sense of gladiator then. Again, some of the stuff with Elendil and Halbrand when they were Numenor as well. One of those quieter moments when she was a bit more calm and collected, I thought I get a little bit of that Cate Blanchett element to the character as well. But as I said, she's very different at this point as well. The other thing about, you know, Isildur as well, we don't get a massive amount of him on this episode, but we get his relationship with his father as well. And we learn that the mother drowned, and we also, so it's very prophetic, given that there was essentially a seafaring people as well. But one thing that really kind of struck me was right at the end, before the mountain explodes as well, when Elendil's carrying that horse Raimi much reminded me of Aragorn carrying Brigo in Two Towers, which again is obviously Elendil and Isildur are the ancestors of Aragorn. And then he agreed to teach Isildur what he learned from a dead mother about raising horses as well. So it was some really lovely moments then, because they've been a bit odds throughout a lot of the series. I think Isildur's been quite impulsive, but I liked how they kind of came together at that moment.
Yeah, although it was weirdly positioned in the episode because it came just after the dam burst. So you've got this big high tension moment of a dam bursting and water pouring down, and then you cut to a quiet scene of them talking about a horse.
True. Maybe it could have been placed before then. That's absolutely fair, yeah. But let's talk about Halbrand then. Obviously, we've got a lot of kind of combination of Halbrand's storyline, where he's been going so far in this episode. The one thing I found really interesting, though, was that connection to Adar. When they capture Adar, he's ready to kill him. And I feel like there's something about a relationship between Adar and Halbrand that we haven't really seen explored in this episode yet.
Yeah, that's where I got the maybe he's Sauron vibes, because Adar talks about how he thinks he killed Sauron.
Ah, yeah, okay.
So it seems like maybe it's that silence this guy before he gives me up, almost.
That'd be interesting. If Halbrand is Sauron, I think particularly for Galadriel, you know, this kind of like fight in the darkness stuff. And they do talk about in this episode. If she's been allied with Sauron the whole time, that's going to be pretty bleak.
Yeah.
What about the scene between Galadriel and Adar in the barn then?
So this is where I would really shoot down the whole Mary Sue argument with Galadriel, because this shows her to be badly flawed at this point in her life, because she doesn't see the fact that Adar is actually quite tragic, as in he's a corrupted elf, and he talks about that. And you even have that mirroring of the seeds, as in he talks about doing that as well. Yeah. He does that as well, in the same way that, for the same reasons. And yeah, it's a bit of a cliche, tragic backstory for Adar, and it still doesn't quite justify him creating Mordor because he was corrupted and turned away from what he was supposed to be. But Galadriel's monstrous because she doesn't see that tragedy. She doesn't see that he is a victim in a way, because what happened to him wasn't his fault. So when he compares her to Sauron, it's actually quite valid.
Yeah.
Because she is just as uncompromising.
Yeah.
And that's that inner darkness as well that we saw in Fellowship that Galadriel has and she struggles with. Again, they didn't do much of that in the Lord of the Rings films. It was just mentioned as a thing. It's like, don't give me the ring, because if I take the ring, I will do horrible things with it. I know I will. Then there's maybe some kind of inner conflict with herself that will manifest over the however many seasons this will have, where she understands that darkness and understands how to keep it at bay, but at the moment she's prone to it and she kind of misjudges Adar in a way. That conversation they have was great,
yeah.
I thought. And she just comes across as a bit fascistic, which is probably something you can attribute to the elves anyway.
Absolutely,
in some cases.
Yeah, it was a wonderful scene. Amid all the great action sequences, I think it was a really wonderful scene. And yeah, she's uncompromising. I think actually you mentioned that whole kind of being corrupted by darkness, when she's offered the ring in Fellowship. I think that scene is probably going to be far more interesting on repeat viewings once we've seen Rings of Power. And that's what a good prequel should do, I think. Because we know the broad story. We kind of almost know where we're going to get to. We know we're going to get to that prologue from the Fellowship. But a really good prologue shouldn't just be telling us what we already know. It's put in what comes after in a new light. It's like, I always find like Star Wars. I really enjoy Rogue One. And I find that A New Hope is so much more desperate given the stakes that happened in Rogue One. It changes the movie. It doesn't completely change the movie. It's still a wonderful movie in its own right. But the stakes seem different because we know what led up to that moment. I guess with Andor, we'll see even more of that now. So I think we're going to see characters in a new light, and you know, and when we look at when they go for Moria in Fellowship of the Ring, or Galadriel is kind of risked the corruption of the ring in the Fellowship as well, I think these scenes were seen in new light because of what's going to happen in the show, which is great. I think that's what you should do.
Yeah, in the extended Fellowship she has one of the rings, doesn't
she has one of the elven rings, and I think Elwyn has one as well. So yeah, there's they don't really do enough of them, but again, it's probably going to be really interesting once we get to the Rings of Power, because we have no Rings of Power in the Rings of Power yet.
No, they haven't even mentioned them, although there was the suggestion that they might be in a box in the first or second episode, but that turned out to be something else. But it's we know nothing about those rings. We just know they were forged, but we don't know what they actually did. So have they got a corrupting influence by themselves? Is there only certain people that can wield them? Do they do anything? Or are they just symbolic? We don't know. They surely must do something because Sauron had to make his own. Mm,
yeah, I mean, that'd be a really interesting plot to develop, I guess, when it comes out. I reckon we're going to see something at the end of the season, and it's going to lead into probably season two, maybe more of the rings. I don't know. But yeah, I really like the scene. I like how there's that scene in, again, I think again it's a Fellowship, when Saruman talks about the Uruk-hai and talks about elves that were twisted into orcs and by the darkness. And I think Adar is that kind of the first kind of proper representation of that, you know, someone who was an elf, who fell to darkness. And now, so actually the orcs that we see in the Rings of Power, and I love the design of the orcs in the show as well. I think they're great.
Yeah, they look good.
Yeah, that actually, then they're not very dissimilar. You know, the orcs of the Rings of Power and Adar are just like, more like the orcs are more like a devolved version of Adar, which is really interesting itself. But I think, yeah, the idea of that he, you know, he may have willingly followed Morgoth, we don't know, but he could have also been corrupted, and we don't know that. But the fact that he said Galadriel makes the assumption that he betrayed everything.
Does he not refer to himself as Uruk as well?
He does, yeah. So yeah, I think the idea of, you know, the Uruk-hai that we see in Lord of the Rings are essentially the true version of what Adar was actually going to be, I think. I guess they're kind of more close to elf than maybe to orc as well. So they are different to the rest of the orcs and the goblins that we see in Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and I guess in these movies as well. So that's really interesting too, the reference to orc. Also, the reference that Adar killed Sauron must be a red herring, but maybe Adar believes that he killed Sauron?
Yeah, he possibly did it out of vengeance or something, or thinks he did it, but they keep talking about Sauron's return, so it suggests that he's gone somewhere, and maybe, lots of people believe he's dead. And I do like the way they fleshed out Adar, because in the Peter Jackson trilogy, the orcs were just evil. Yeah. That was it. And any orc that had a voice, they always said such horrible things. And some of them didn't. And most of them didn't have a voice, but the ones that spoke did say horrible things, and they took pleasure in being sadistic and things like that. And I know there's a lot going around at the moment. I've got a friend who deals with who plays D&D, and she's mixed race. And she talks about the pigeonholing of races in Dungeons & Dragons, which is obviously heavily influenced by Lord of the Rings in terms of the basic setup. But I wonder if Adar himself is a critique of Tolkien's simplicity in the way that he framed these races, because orcs, people have read them as negative representations of people of colour, mixed race people, immigrants, all that sort of stuff. And they're very shallowly portrayed, as I said, in the movies and books with no differing perspective. You never get a good orc, quote unquote. And I won't say Adar is a good orc, but he's complicated, and you can see where he's coming from in some ways. As in, when he talks about what motivates him to do what he does, you think, I see how you got there. So he's a character rather than just something that needs to be killed or defeated. So yeah, he adds dimension, and he's somewhat corrupted. It's not a fix for that problem that has existed for decades, but it's something. It's something a bit different.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's very, very, and I like that the characters in this aren't quite so black and white. Even like Gil-galad, the High Elf King, he's obviously got a devious side. You see that, the way he sent Galadriel away and the way he's kind of manipulating the dwarves with the mithril as well and stuff. So, you know, it talks about the stuff about, you know, they need the mithril to keep the light of the elves alive and keep them immortal. But you know, he's got a very underhanded way of doing things as well. So even though kind of what's supposed to be the purest of characters aren't kind of just aren't black or white, you know, there were different shades, which I'm really enjoying too.
I've always been suspicious of the elves anyway, in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit as well. I forget the character's name, is it Legolas, his father?
Thranduil, he's a bit of an arse, isn't he?
Yeah, and even Elrond sticks his nose up, turns his nose up at people in The Lord of the Rings. He's supposed to be the good one, so to speak. But they sit there in their, you know, overly clean palaces and don't let people in. And, you know, they shun away outsiders, and it's only the odd outsider that gets to come in. Only friends of the you know, the highborn, the exceptions, people like Gandalf and so forth, and whoever Gandalf brings with him, I suppose. But yeah, I've always been suspicious of them. They're just elitist.
They are. You know, just, they are.
They aren't very nice people.
Yeah. But also, yeah, I think that, and even with Galadriel herself, and one thing I really like, you touched on it as well, about the darkness of Galadriel. There's a wonderful line that Adar says, perhaps you should have ended your search for Morgoth's successor by looking in the mirror. And the way, yeah, and yeah, the way that she actually could be the darkness too, I think is a really interesting, again, which leads to a connection with Halbrand, and actually interesting that Halbrand stops her from killing him.
Yeah.
I think that's why Halbrand and Galadriel are kind of drawn to each other. I think whether it's romantic or not, there's definitely a connection between them. There's a good chemistry between the actors as well. But there's definitely a connection. And I think it's that darkness in both of them.
They're both quite damaged people. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a couple of scenes then before we get to the volcano as well. There's the scene where Bronwyn meets Meriel and Halbrand's proclamation as king. It's probably the most short-lived coronation ever.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those, again, these brief moments of victory. And I think it's supposed to echo Return of the King.
Mm.
Although it's a much smaller ceremony, but it's the idea of we're here, everything's resolved. Here's the true king. Here we go. And then, oh no. Everything's destroyed.
Yeah, literally, it's all hell. The true king of the Southlands, and then eruption. It's the volcano. It's. But I like how that is Halbrand's storyline has always felt like that kind of slightly twisted reversal of the of Aragorn's. That's why I think he's saying. I think he's. Yeah, you know, he could be Sauron. I think he's the Witch King, but who knows? I don't know who he is, but I don't necessarily think it's going to be a happy ending. Certainly, and. It feels like they're doing the kind of the reversal of Aragorn.
Yeah, well, he has a couple of choices. He can move his people, or he can try and make something out of the hell that they now live in.
Yeah, I'm interested to see the kind of the outcome of that. So let's just talk about that kind of final twist then. So we get that big twist that the dagger is part of the device to activate the volcano, and that beautiful snow-capped mountain we're watching in the distance is Mount Doom. What did you think then of the ending?
I thought it was suitably dramatic. The dagger's been this weird object that's been sitting around for a while with the suggestions of its purpose. But yeah, this as a key to reactivate the volcano, it was good because we'd seen the object before. So it didn't just come out of nowhere, which was, you know, I'm always a fan of, yeah, this has been around for a while. This is what it does. I always like when you get that payoff and yeah, the I suppose the twist of, oh, this unassuming mountain. Oh, yeah, it's a volcano, and here it's back turned on again, and now it's going to be the centre of this hellscape that people will call home for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was kind of like a twisted version of Aragorn's blade and Durell in Return of the King, and actually, you know, particularly Halbrand's storyline, that was used as this kind of mythical blade of kind of the heroic king that was going to brought for darkness rather than light. The fact that he's actually just part of a kind of contraption built by Adar, and I like how it came together. What was the point of all these tunnels? And it all came together to kind of flood, to break the dams, to kind of kickstart the inside of the volcano, and just go full on Pompeii as well. I thought it felt like everything had come together, and I suddenly understood where this storyline was going.
Yeah, it's the classic use of lava in fiction, though, isn't it? Yeah, we can be this close to it and it does nothing.
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't hit us, we're fine.
Yeah, yeah. It obviously wasn't a completely dormant volcano, but he just needed a kickstart. I mean, maybe we're getting all the things. You can kind of have a bit of magic was involved as well. Maybe the blade was magical. I don't know. But yeah, it was very cool. And when you got that kind of the panic as the ash clouds rolled in, and Galadriel in armor standing, facing off against the roaring ash clouds, well, that was an ending. That was a great ending.
Yeah. It was, yeah, suitably dramatic, like I said. And I didn't really see the episode ending that way. I thought we'd get to bask in the victory for a while and then recalibrate in terms of now that these two stories have combined, let's spend a bit of time maybe seeing how these characters that can now interact with one another in a more sedate way before things kick off again. So as much as I railed against the pacing earlier, I wonder if it would have been maybe even half an episode of just... Here's us victorious, and here's these internal strife that we can come across, and whatever. But no, they just rush straight to it.
Yeah, but I kind of mostly worked. I think. But even though once you realised you with that map, and you saw the Numenor arriving, and you realised, oh, okay, this is Mordor. I still did not expect mountains. Even when you saw the mountain you look at that mountain you've seen in several episodes in a whole new light, and you thought, this is Mount Doom. But I still didn't expect it to be the Mount Doom we see at the end. So I don't know. I guess it gives faith that there's a lot to get through on the show as well, and maybe this is our patience being rewarded. You know, showing that actually it's not just going to be world building. We're going to pay off. I'm quite excited for the final two episodes to see what they're going to do now. Because again, I have no idea where this show is going. I say broad strokes, but apart from the fall of Moria and the Forging of the Rings and the final defeat of Sauron, I know nothing. And that's over four seasons of storytelling still to happen. So I don't know if Moria Khazad-dûm is going to end this season or it's going to end in season three. I hope it's later rather than sooner, because I love the dwarves as well. But we don't know what's going to happen, and that's great. But I think the ending of this episode, the fact that it went so big, so quickly, has me excited for what the final two episodes are going to be. That Mount Doom could have been the finale, and it probably would have worked just as well. But the fact it's happened here is really exciting.
Well, we had the Balrog mentioned in the previous episode. And I'm sure one of the trailers showed a Balrog.
Yeah,
as well.
I hope that was a tease, and I don't want to see the Balrog this season, because I think maybe because we've had Mount Doom, I always want to savor what this means for the show, and not have, because I think the Balrog laying waste to Khazad-dûm is going to be so tragic and so epic that it almost covering two episodes of this ending would be really particularly bleak. But you know, maybe that's what the finale of season one is going to be about.
Maybe, but I feel like we maybe need a bit more time with the dwarves and to see how their society works.
I agree.
To see how much it's thriving, because we only really had the Elrond Durin perspective so far. We've had a bit of a tour of their mining operation and things like that, but maybe we need a few more actual characters in there.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's just a bunch of cannon fodder, I suppose, being sacrificed to a Balrog. And I think that's part of the problem in this episode as well, is there are so many characters, but we don't know a lot of them all that well because there are so many characters.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the actual stakes, it's you have to wonder why we're supposed to be invested in some of them. And obviously no big ticket characters die in this battle anyway. So there's that side of it too. But yeah, I think we need a bit more focus on the dwarves before they get wiped out.
I hope it's at least end of season two. Because I agree, I just love everything. The dwarves. I love Disa as well, the wife as well. So I want more of that. I want lots more of that. I'm enjoying seeing the dwarves in all their glory, because we've seen them what happens after they've fallen. We've seen them in The Hobbit. We saw it in Lord of the Rings. I want to see them in all their glory, and for as long as possible too.
Yeah, and you almost need Elrond to distance himself from them before that happens.
Yeah,
he doesn't seem to know what's going on outside his borders when you get to Lord of the Rings. So it's almost like he has to move away from that, because his arc has largely been, oh yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot about you.
Yeah.
So it's weird that we're starting there, because that's where he ends up. So yeah. I'm sorry, I forgot about you. I wouldn't do it again. I'm just going to do it again.
Maybe, I don't know. I think again, the fallout of Durin and Elrond's going to be tragic too. Maybe more personal stakes, but because I love them together. I love them. I would happily watch a whole series of Elrond, Disa and Durin at a dinner table. I love them a bit. So I hope we get more of that before it all goes to pot, because everything is going to go pot.
Well, I want a flashback to the story they talk about how they met. There's the two different takes on it.
Great. Yeah, just that would be absolutely fun. But yeah, we shall see. So any kind of closing thoughts then on this episode or the Rings of Power in general?
I don't think so. I think I've covered most of my notes.
Brilliant. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking Lord of the Rings with you, Craig. I know we've podcasted many times before, but the first time I think we've discussed World of Tolkien. So where can people find you online if they want to talk Lord of the Rings or anything else with you?
So mostly you can find me under Neil Before Blog. So that's on neilbeforeblog.co.uk. It's on Facebook and Twitter as well. Just type it in, you'll find it. I review, at the moment I'm not reviewing that much. I'm reviewing She-Hulk, and there's a couple of things that will be starting quite soon that I'll be reviewing. The Winchesters, which is the Supernatural prequel. I'm planning to review that, unless I watch the first episode and find out I've got nothing to say about it, which can happen. But I'm planning to review that, and I review films as well. There's an attached podcast called Neil Before Pod. We'll be talking about Marvel and Star Trek and all that sort of stuff. So you can find me there mainly. And on We Made This, you can find me all over the place. I'm mostly guesting on things, although I am co-running Rarely Going, which is the Star Trek animated show. So I'll be back for the finale of that with Lower Decks 10th episode in a few weeks. So that'll be exciting. And personally on Twitter, you can find me under Nemesis4909, which is not originally a Star Trek reference, as I'm obliged to say. It started life as a Resident Evil reference and then later became a Star Trek reference. So there we go. I have fulfilled my contractual obligation. But those are the main places you can find me.
Excellent. Yeah. And always you can find me on Twitter at Baz Green, where I post all my podcasts, my books, and then obviously on We Made This, there's the A Dream Given Form, the Babylon 5 podcast. I co-host with One More Than All host Luke as well, and the TARDIS Crew .2 podcast I host with my son Ben. And of course, you can find One Rules and More on Twitter by searching One Rules and More as well. So thanks for joining us for another episode. And please remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to One Rules and More. And please give us a rating review on our podcast. We'd really love to hear your thoughts and get more readers out there. Next week, I'll continue hosting duties with another guest, Robert Turnbull, as we look at the penultimate episode of The Rings of Power, Season 1. Until then, remember, even the smallest person can change the course of the future.